Blog Talk Radio.
I wonder what would happen if we just did some random acts of kindness. Stop killing each other. Strength of a million men being kind. Turn this whole thing around. One man would make up his mind to everyone he meets, be kind, and fix his heart on that which is true. If one man would be so bold as to embrace the gospel and hold, just think what the strength of a million men could do. If one man changed his thought each time the tempter brought some selfish scheme that would his neighbor undo. If he thought for just a minute, just where is the kindness in it? Just think what a million thoughts like that could do. If David could slay that giant, though huge and extremely defiant, and Solomon had the wisdom to think things through, if Shadrach could walk through fire and his entire village inspire, just think what a million Shadrachs could do. If Noah could build that ark, though some people thought it a lark, and Jesus could cure those deaf and blind men too, if Samson's strength was that of 10 ordinary men, just think what a million Samsons could do. If one man would take a second when his needy neighbor beckoned and followed literally Moses' 10th command, with spirits filled and nourished, our neighborhoods would flourish. How quickly peace would spread throughout this land. If one man made up his mind to no matter what, be kind, no matter what others might put him through, the strength of that man's resolve would all our problems solve. And just think what a million men like that could do. Just a little kindness. Simple virtue of kindness.
Welcome to In Search of Fatherhood, which moderates a global dialogue on issues impacting fathers, their communities, and our world, courtesy of the Tribe Family Channel Network. I'm your host, Diane Sears. You're going to be hearing from dynamic souls who are working to turn our upside-down world right side up. Ms. Martea Brown from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who will be joined by Sam, a member of a group of thought leaders from United Community Action Network, which created a global model for eradicating fatherlessness and intergenerational incarceration. And that model is known as the Fathers and Children Together Initiative. From Denmark, we have Mrs. Nine Bernstorff-Reichlaw, who will talk to us about finding our purpose, overcoming the environment that we were born into, and how to become our best self. And from Atlanta, Georgia, we have Dr. Latrice Wallen, who will unveil a groundbreaking collaborative fatherhood book project which explores the lives of African-American fathers and the challenges they hurdle over day after day. You can jump into the conversation and speak with our guests by dialing 347-539-5285. That's 347-539-5285. Before we go to our first guest, I'm going to give you some background information about each of our guests. Ms. Martea Brown is a restorative justice advocate who played a pivotal role in the launch and implementation of the Fathers and Children Together Initiative, which is a two-tier parenting program created by a group of thought leaders who are members of United Community Action Network and the Latino American Cultural Exchange Organization. During our talk with Ms. Brown, we will also hear from Sam, the chairman of United Community Action Network and co-architect of the Fathers and Children Together Initiative. Ms. Brown is also a member of the Coalition Against Death by Incarceration, and she has facilitated educational forums in Philadelphia which provide community members with information about proposed criminal justice reform legislation. Mrs. Nye Bernstall Frank Love lives and works in Denmark, where she is the owner of NBR Coaching and is a founding partner and lead consultant, Noble Consulting. Mrs. Frank Love is an executive and leader performance coach, fundraising and strategy consultant, mentor, and transformational speaker who has lived and worked in the United States, Africa, Asia, and Europe. She has worked in the United Nations as a senior development officer and has held the positions of chief of staff and fundraising director at non-governmental organizations. And from Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Latrice Blomes is the Assistant Director of Evaluation and Institutional Assessment at Morehouse College's School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Rollins is launching a groundbreaking and collaborative fatherhood book project, engaging and working with fathers' strategies and lessons learned, which provides an extraordinary look into the lives of African-American fathers. She brings together a unique group of fatherhood practitioners working with African-American fathers to help restore. Hello, everyone. How is everyone? That's great. We're going to get the conversation started with our first guest, Ms. Martea Brown. Ms. Brown, are you there, please?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us. Why don't we just get right to it? Let's talk about the Fathers and Children Together Initiative. Tell our audience how it all started and what was it like for you to witness the launch of this dynamic and historic initiative.
Fathers and Children Together started inside of the prison. The gentleman inside recognized that the father was kind of disconnected with the children. So they came up with an idea to start letting the children come in. We take the mothers out to eat, and the children spend quality time with the fathers.
That's great. What was your role in helping to launch this powerful initiative, coordinating its administration, and getting the community to embrace it?
My role was to make calls to the mothers, do orientations with the mothers and the children, take the children up to the prison, and then go out to dinner with the mothers while the children reunite with the fathers. We also do one-on-ones with the mothers. You know, if they have any concerns, we sit at the table, eat dinner, and talk about it. And we try to assist them in any way we can. That's basically how it went.
So the fathers that were selected for the program, the gentlemen, the thought leaders on the inside, they helped select these gentlemen. Is that right?
Yes, they did. They did orientations with the fathers. The guys sign up applications. They review them. and they do was doing orientation with them. It's an intense class. They do the classes for 2 weeks, and then while we're doing the classes with the mothers for 2 weeks, and then we start the process of bringing the children up to the prison.
I see. So actually, by selecting the father and getting the fathers in the program, that simultaneously moves the mothers and children into the program.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, these are fathers who have been wanting to connect with their parent, with their children, always, but they just didn't know how. So what they do is they have a psychiatrist. They have a big support team that goes into the prison, and they have classes, and they talk to them and get them prepped before the children actually comes into the prison to visit with their biological fathers.
This is phenomenal. Now, I understand that the Fathers and Children Together initiative seems to be raising the village. The fathers attending the training session develop a friendship with each other, which continues after their release from prison, and they rejoin their families. The mother who goes through the session becomes friends with each other, and they create a sisterhood. So you have a brotherhood being created, a sisterhood being created, and the children who participated in the initiative, they develop a lasting friendship. It seems that everyone participating in the initiative is positively transformed. Do you want to talk about that? Like, how does that happen? And was that a part of the initiative? Was that one of the goals of the initiative?
Yes, that's part of the plan to reunite. And you see tears. I mean, after those children come out from visiting with their father, especially the first and last visit, they do, I believe it's 4 weeks. They go up every week, every Friday, for 4 consecutive weeks, and then they have a graduation. And to see the tears and the tears of joy on those children's faces are phenomenal. I've never seen anything like it. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. Because some of those children that we have taken up were 16 and never seen their father since they first went in prison at ages, I'm going to say one, for 15 years. So to be able to reconnect with the father, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. The guys in Greaterford, they worked hard to put it together, and it's beautiful. I can't even stop talking about it. It's just it's phenomenal.
That's what I hear. Now,
mm-hmm.
You work tirelessly on restorative justice and criminal justice reform initiatives. In December of 2017, you orchestrated successful community meetings supportive of Pennsylvania House Bill 135, introduced by Pennsylvania State Representative the Honorable Jason Dawkins, and a similar bill introduced by Pennsylvania State Senator Sherman Street. Can you talk to us about this legislation? And talk to us about how you pulled these communities together. I mean, you had a phenomenal attendance. I think it was somewhere around 250 people or something like that. So tell us all about it.
Yes, okay. It started out with a House Bill 2135 that Jason Dawkins presented back in 2016. It's to give the lifers a second chance, not saying that every lifer would get out, but to have them reviewed for them to prove that they have changed and to, you know, bring them back into society. So the House Bill 2135, after we went up and rallied in Harrisburg, it turned into House Bill 135. The number changes after 2 years. The House Bill 135, and then we had a Senate bill, which Sharif Street presented, and that was the House Bill 942. Both bills are kind of like the same. What I did was had a forum in Southwest Philadelphia. I had approximately, I'm going to say 300 people there. I had Jason Dawkins there. I had Sharif Street there. I had Janie Becker. I had a lot of people, important people there, so we can educate our community on what we're trying to do. And that's what we do in our community. We make a difference. We try to make a difference, but we do not. We don't believe in leaving our community out. So we all work together. Actually, I'm on my way into a meeting today. I have ward leaders and committee people who are trying. They want to all get together, and we're going to work together in Southwest Philadelphia to make a difference. And that's the work that I do all the time, every day.
That is phenomenal. I can personally vouch for the fact that you are a phenomenal soul who works tirelessly to make the world a better and safer place and a vibrant place. I don't know where you get your energy from.
The man up above, the man up above gives us all assignments. And when you have assignment, either you go out and do the work or you miss it. So I try to go out and do all the assignments that he gives me, you know. Oh, this is my calling, so I'm going out there today. And I'm going to, you know, do what I need to do because the Lord put it on my heart. And that's the way I work daily.
That is beautiful. I know you have to run to the meeting, but I'm going to ask you one more question, if I may. I want to talk to you about the Coalition Against Death by Incarceration. You are a very proactive member of this group, which is known as CADB. Talk to us about your work with CADB.
CADB, I am currently active member with CADB. We meet once a month. We go to Harrisburg, we rally, we fight for the lifers in the state of Pennsylvania. We have meetings, we have strategy meetings on how we can help with the gentleman on the inside, the Lions organization. R2R. Those are different organizations. You wouldn't believe the organization that they have inside the prison. But CADB goes inside those prisons, and we work closely with those men because I say they're college men. Behind those walls are college men. So CADB works, we work hard, and we work with the gentlemen on the inside of the prison, and we also do a lot of work with people outside the prison who's having, like, issues. Their family members are having issues with their loved ones on the inside. So we make phone calls. I just had a young lady call me yesterday who was telling me that her son was sick in the prison. I said, well, I'll tell you what. By Monday morning, we'll be calling up, and if we have to, we'll go up there and find out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of work that we do in CADB.
I understand that CADB has done a lot of work with juvenile lifers and getting them resentencing hearings and getting them released. We have, in Pennsylvania, we have a number of individuals who were sentenced as juveniles to life sentences who are now being released or have been released and are out and about in society and doing quite well.
Our juvenile lifers are doing phenomenal. We work close with them, and I'm glad you asked that question because I definitely don't want to miss talking about our juvenile lifers who has came home and has been doing positive things ever since. I had one young man who has been home for approximately 14 months, and he worked with the lifers one-on-one, and he has them on the right track. If any of them have a problem, they go to him. And those gentlemen come right to Cabby, and they start working with us in the organization to help the gentleman on the inside so they can get released. You know, we try to come up with a plan to help get these gentlemen released, the ones that we know have made a difference since being incarcerated. Not saying that everybody's coming home, that's for sure, but ones that we know have made a difference, we're working hard.
Yeah, I've had a chance to watch Kathy from a distance. They are very they're very proactive. They rally the community. They get the community information that's needed about the individual juvenile lifer and their sentencing and the whole resentencing hearing. And they pack the hearing. The resentencing hearings are packed. It's like
they show up in numbers. You hear me? When we know, like, I have a nephew that's going to court April the 30th. And they are all calling me now. Keep us in mind. Tell us the date, but we have a meeting next Wednesday. So they all show up. They're very supportive. Very, very supportive. And that's one of the best organizations I have worked with so far. You know, except for what I had an organization called Southwest Reunited Communities, and and what we did was work. We walked through Southwest Philadelphia, and we found out what was going on. We went to the meeting, and we made a difference in the Southwest Philadelphia area. We had a school that had a big pothole, and that pothole, every time it rained, it would be full of water. The children would go out and play in that yard the next day. So just so happened, I was at a meeting one day at the 12th District, which is our police district, and they had visitors there. The city was there, and I was able to address that. Within 2 days, they came out, fixed that pothole, and the children was able to play again. So that's just a small bit of what I do and my organization does from Southwest Philadelphia.
That is phenomenal.
Yes. But I just can't say it enough. Those guys inside the prison, they came up with the UCAN, United Community Action Network. That's what UCAN stands for. And the guys in Greaterford Prison came up with that in 2007.
Do you have time to take a call? We have a caller from area code 252. Caller from area code 252, are you on the line, and could you identify yourself? Please give us your first name. You're speaking with our guest, Ms. Martea Brown. Caller, are you there? Okay, we seem to have lost the call. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
UPenn
is a very powerful organization, and they have done multiple things inside the prison from 2007 on up to 2012. After 2012, that's when the gentleman came up with the FACT program, Father and Children Together. So, UPenn have done multiple things. They had a old school, new school call out, and that was held at Community College. They had over 3,000 people there. Now, these are gentlemen, we're talking about people working from the inside out. Over 3,000 people showed up.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, I think it's important that our audience knows and understands that many of the gentlemen that are incarcerated have turned their lives around and are creating and implementing programs from the inside that are addressing a lot of the key challenges that we're all struggling with on the outside, like intergenerational incarceration, recidivism, fatherlessness. It's phenomenal what they're able to do. I mean, and they brainstorm, they research these things. Look at data. They're just absolutely brilliant. And we were going to have one of those gentlemen join us, but it looks like he's not going to be able to.
I just want to say this. Anybody, first of all, 9 times out of 10, when people get involved with things that's going on inside the prison walls, they normally 9 times out of 10 have family members. But even the ones without family members, if you connect with someone in prison and find out how much love and how much smartness those young men have, and Greater for Prison, all around, not just Greater for all the prisons, you would definitely want to be connected into some type of organization or program to get these gentlemen who have made a difference and a change in their life out after 20 years. I say 20 years because I remember life used to be 20 years in the state of Pennsylvania. So that's why I say 20 years. I'm sitting here now with a city council, city of Philadelphia citation to my brother. And this was from the city council. And he received this for such well job in the UPenn program, with the UPenn program. He received this in 2015. I'm just going to say two things. He has, from the House of Representatives, he received this in 2016, from the House of Representatives, a citation. So these gentlemen, and I have more, but I don't want to take up too much time, but these men are phenomenal. This man that I'm talking about with all these citations, which is my brother, and this is why I strive so hard, daily, day and night. This is what does he do on the inside, day and night, because he wants to make a difference. We need him. We need some of these men out here to make a change for some of the men who don't know which way to go.
I there's one thing I'd like our audience to know is that there's something very special about creatorship. I know they have programs in a lot of institutions, but I have never seen or witnessed the level of effective programs such as the one that the gentleman consistently put together and facilitate at Greaterford, to the point that you have judges, you have legislators, you have people from the interfaith community going to Greaterford, meeting with these gentlemen and saying, okay, what is your solution for these challenges? Tell us what we need to do. I call Greaterford University because it is. It's like a university.
Yes. Yes. So you wanted to, I'm sorry, because someone had tried to call in and I was trying to get them off, trying to knock the call off. What was your question? Can you ask that again?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, can you ask that? You was asked the question, the last question you just asked. Can you ask that again?
Okay, is he on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you? Okay. Okay. What is this question that you'd like me to ask? Hello, are you there?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Okay. What is the question that you'd like me to ask again?
No, no, you were asking me a question. This is
okay. I was talking about the fact that I refer to Greaterford as Greaterford University. A lot of the judges here, and particularly it's from Philadelphia, city council, lawyers, particularly criminal lawyers, you have judges, you have members from the interfaith community that go to Greaterford frequently to meet with the gentleman that put together the old school, new school call out, the Fathers and Children Together initiative. They meet with them seeking answers on how to resolve a lot of these key challenges that is crippling our community. Key challenges such as fatherlessness, violence, mass incarceration, the school to prison pipeline, and even how to mentor at risk youth. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah. I have never seen a group of men so educated in my life. I know they could stay fed out for years. So while they were sitting, they was doing some homework and studying, okay?
They are phenomenal. Ms. Brown,
yes.
I know you have to go to your meeting. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a great weekend, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing. We thank you, we admire you, and you're such an inspiration. Take care.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a beautiful and blessed day. Thank you for having me on, Dr. Schultz.
Not a problem. I'm happy to do it. Ladies and gentlemen, you just heard from Ms. Martea Brown, a restorative justice advocate from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Just wanted to remind you that you can jump into the conversation by calling 347-539-5285, 347-539-5285. And we have two more guests waiting patiently. We have Beck, called from Denmark. We have Nine Bernstorff Reichlaw. This is Nine Bernstorff Reichlaw. And after we speak with her, we'll be talking with Dr. Latrice Wallace. Mrs. Frank, well, thank you so much for your patience. How are you? And welcome.
Thank you so much, Diane. I'm doing great. It was very exciting listening to the first conversation here. Very inspiring work going on. And thank you so much for bringing me on your show. And also, I want to congratulate you on the very great work that you're doing. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. I think we have a mutual admiration society going on here.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah. Now, let's talk about you. You have worked as a senior development officer within the United Nations. You've held the position of chief of staff and fundraising director and a number of non-governmental organizations. Did you find your work at the United Nations as a senior development officer and at non-governmental organizations in the capacity of chief of staff and fundraising director to be fulfilling and intellectually stimulating?
I love that question. So I worked in the UN for about 8 years, and then I switched over to the non-governmental organizational work. And then I've been back at the UN doing some work for them in the last couple of years. And one of the things that I found is that when I joined the UN, it had always been sort of a dream of mine to work with human advocacy issues, to work with human development issues. And I have always felt that the UN must be a platform for which you can really make great change. And I found that in many cases, it was an amazing platform. It was inspiring. I felt motivated. I especially enjoyed the times when I got to go to the field and really work with the people one-to-one on the ground, the ones that are the beneficiaries, and where you can really see that you're making a difference in these people's lives. But it wasn't really until I came to the NGOs that I could really see how blessed we are when we work at the UN, because truly it gives us an opportunity and a door opening in many ways, whereas at the NGO level, you know, we do have to fight a little harder. Resources are maybe not as available to us, especially with my background working in resource mobilization, fundraising. It was a very different thing, but it was motivating. I've met some very truly extraordinary people in my work, and I've been humbled by what I've seen people being capable of doing, even when they don't really have any resources. They still power through.
So describe for our audience what it's like to work with people from around the world, particularly at the United Nations. At the United Nations, you have individuals from diverse cultures, diverse professional backgrounds. It's like really interacting with the entire world. What was that like? What was the energy like? I mean, what?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is actually, as you say, it is like, you know, trying to work with the entire world all at once. So it is intense. I think that's one word to describe it. It is intense because you do have to bring a certain level of sensitivity towards other people's cultures, their backgrounds. In my current work as a coach, I often talk about, you know, what's the skill set of active listening? And I think that was one of the skill sets I learned at the UN, because you do have to listen very actively when a person is talking to you and you really do not seem to have a lot in common in terms of where you were brought up, what you have seen, your values, and you come together in a workplace and you're trying to solve very complex problems. So the energy at times can be quite hectic because, you know, you have maybe time crunches. I worked a lot with refugee issues. So a lot of times you will have situations where you don't have a lot of time to solve the problem at hand. But most of all, I found it inspiring. It's truly inspiring to get to sit in a meeting and you have people who come from so at the UN, there is a rule that you will take employees from different member states. So even very small communities, let's say from Africa, will have a chance to have people working at UN headquarters. So sitting in meetings where you have people who come from, I had a village prince. He was going to be, the king of his little community where he was coming from. And it was the first time that he had ever been abroad was when he got the position in Geneva. So you would have someone like him, and then you would have people from small island states in Hawaii and in Indonesia, and you know, you would have people from Europe, Middle East, I think one of the we were laughing because we were in a meeting and there were almost 20 people, and English and French and Spanish are some of the languages that you're expected to speak when you are at the UN, but we tend to gravitate towards English as one of the main languages. And and at one point, you know, we were in a very heated discussion, and I think it got so heated just simply because of a language barrier, because people hear different things when English is not their first language. So I think, you know, it's like looking at it at different layers. And once you start digging in, there are lots of diverse skill sets you need to apply to be able to accomplish results in a diverse work culture like the UN. But it is truly inspiring and a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like this experience forces you to really look at things from the other person's perspective. You sort of have to step out of yourself and transcend whatever boundaries that you have, so that you can really understand the heart and soul of the other person.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said. Yeah, exactly. That is spot on.
Yeah, I have a feeling that this helps you to think about what your purpose is. You are a very purpose-driven person. Does that experience move you to think about what your purpose was? Did it put you on a journey to search for answers about what you were here on Earth to do and how you could help people overcome the environment that they were born into?
Yes, absolutely. I found myself in different situations where I very much started questioning, why am I here? You know, why? I've been in situations where you get in, you get into a country and there's been an earthquake or there has been a war or there has been another type of disaster. And a lot of people might have, you know, lost their lives. You see families that have been torn apart, people who have been through situations which really leaves them scarred for life. And I don't think that you can go into those kind of work situations and come out of them without questioning, what's the purpose? You know, why are we here? Why am I here? What do I want to leave behind? What can I do? And I think it was 2 years into my career, and I have been 27. And I experienced something where a mother had 6 children, and she was not able to take 2 of them to the hospital, and she had to leave 1 child behind. And we were in such a rural area of the country that we really, you know, there was nothing we could do. And the realization that you, in that instance, have to choose one over the other, I think that was the first time I experienced that I need to do something with my life which is of service. You know, it is of service to other people. And I know this might sound grand, but I truly say it in the most humble sense, but it does make you sort of stripped to the bone, and there's nothing left. And you just look at that situation and say, if I am privileged enough, because I come from Denmark, and, you know, we have no issues in Denmark. We like to think that we do, but we really don't. And I think that situation just taught me, you know, it's about being humble. It's about gratitude. It's about loving every second of your life because it's been given to you. You don't know for how long, and you're just so fortunate when you do not have to face situations like that. And so for that, I took that away and said, okay, I need to be of service in everything I do. So that's what I strive for when I get up in the morning. And even in you know, tiny steps, it doesn't have to be grand. I think sometimes people feel that you know, having a life mission or a vision for your life has to be very grand and filled with complex problem solving. But I really feel you should just start small. Whatever difference you can do today, do that. Start there. That's the most important thing.
That situation that you described is so heart-wrenching. When you think about that mother and what she's going through, and when you put that up against some of the things that I may think are gargantuan, or issues that I think are real issues, it pales in comparison to what that woman went through. I just can't imagine being in that position and having that decision to make.
Exactly.
That really really makes you rethink about what you think is important and what you think is an issue.
Exactly.
Let's talk about performance coaching and mentoring. That seems to be your path. And is that the reason you decided to become an executive and leader performance coach and launch NBR Coaching and Noble Consulting?
Yeah, it is. I mean, my background before I got into the development sector, I have an education as a classical violinist. So growing up, I had a lot of coaching and mentoring around performance, as you do as a musician, playing concerts and going to competitions. So when my career took a different turn and I went into the UN and NGO work, and I moved back with my husband. We had spent time abroad for about 6 years, and we decided it was time to go back to Denmark, and I thought about, what do I want to do? Like, what's my next career step? And Noble Consulting was founded on the principle of trying to help businesses become more sustainable and work with the development sector to solve some of the issues that are, you know, faced by the third world countries and by people at the bottom of the pyramid. And after I'd done that for a while, I thought, you know what, I need to do something that's much more hands-on. And I kept seeing, you know, what I like to call luxury problems, you know, people who have a lot of opportunity, a lot of drive, a lot of ambition, and they want to go to the top, and they get to the top, and then they find new issues, and they constantly, you know, look at how can they also help improve the world. And I thought, this is where I can really make a difference. You know, this is where, if I can work with these people and give them some of my experiences from what it's like working with people who have absolutely nothing, and help change mindsets as to what we perceive as, you know, I like to say to my clients, when they have certain situations and they want to discuss strategies, a lot of times people go straight, when you're coaching, they go straight into, what's my strategy for solving this problem? And I always like to say, well, is that a good problem to have? You know, what you're describing, is that a great problem to have? Because I find that makes people sort of reflect on, you know, the lady with the children I was talking about, you know, she didn't have that choice. She couldn't say, is this a great problem to have? She was in such a dire state, she needed to make a decision to save her other children. But I find that most of the time we get so caught up in our emotions and our feelings and our thought patterns, and we don't reflect on the situation we're in and look at where those feelings and thoughts come from. You know, is it people always feel, oh, it's something from the outside, and the outside is doing this to me, and now I have to react, and I have to be negative about it. So much of my drive and my passion is trying to get people to change their mindset, which is a fascinating thing to work with.
I can tell, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about visualization, positive thoughts, and manifestation. Can these tools help us transcend the environment we were born into and be our best self? Could you talk to us a little bit about that and give us some idea as to how we can use these tools to become our best selves and what they are?
Absolutely. So first of all, I love that question because it's something that is sort of an ongoing discussion between people who study this, people who study the mind, the way the mind works, the way the brain works, the way positive thinking works. And I think one of the conclusions so far, and also from what I'm seeing in my work, is that we cannot control our thoughts. So there was a point in time a while back where, you know, the law of attraction, I don't know if you're familiar with the book and the movie The Secret, but when that came out, people were very drawn to the law of attraction, which basically states if you try to manifest something, if you think about it enough, if you have positive thoughts around it, you will attract it in the universe, and that flow will then come into your life, and you can attract money and wealth and, you know, people and whatever it is. And I think the result from that is really people tend to get a little non-engaged, and they don't work. They forget to do the action. So I think to answer your question, what are the tools that we can use? Yes, positive thinking. I mean, some of the people I've met that have been the most positive people have actually been people who have very little. So you will meet someone who has, you know, they live in a small hut. They have no real value, you know, tangible values of any kind. And they're still very happy when they get up in the morning and they go to their job, whatever it is, and they make a living and spend time with their family. And life somehow seems to be very simple to them. And when I have had conversations with them about what makes you happy, and they say, well, it's just inside me. It is inside me. I just feel happy inside me. And I think that's very different from, you know, positive thinking. Because positive thinking kind of implies that we have to somehow control our minds to stay positive, which is an absolute impossibility in my world. You know, that can never happen because thoughts are like ebb and flow. They come, they go, and then they come again and they go again. And there's really no control to it. And once we start controlling it, it all becomes very it becomes very manipulative and very sort of tense is a word to describe it. So instead, look at it to say, well, if it's something inside you, everything you're experiencing is actually an inside-out experience. It's not an outside-in. And if you really truly think about that as a concept to say everything comes from the inside and out, then you start realizing, well, if that's the truth and I have a negative thought, another thought will come along in a minute and that will replace the thought I'm having now. So maybe getting so caught up, which is what happens to people, right? They get caught up, is the ability to slow down, breathe, acknowledge that the thoughts are ebb and flow, they will come and go, and that the actions we take doesn't always have to be a reaction to what we perceive as something happening outside of us. So I know this is not, you know, it's not a quick fix. I sometimes have clients that are like, well, I don't know. I don't understand what you're saying, or I don't agree with that because they don't seem to be able to apply it very quickly into their lives. But it's, you know, it's a lifelong process. But my key words are always, you know, it's ebb and flows. It's just a thought. Another thought will come along in a minute. And then try and see what that does to your life if you just stick to that. Very, very basic, very simple.
Okay, I get that. Most of us look from the outside. We look for external things to make us happy. And the truth of the matter is we're responsible for our own happiness. And the most happiest people in the world, the most well-adjusted people in the world, and the most successful people in the world, they kind of know that.
Yes, exactly. And it's really funny because I'm doing sort of a research study at the moment where I'm comparing the happiness level and the reason behind it between, you know, people who seem to have achieved it all and people who have absolutely nothing. And in that research, it's starting to point towards that the people who are actually very, very successful, if they can achieve a mental state of feeling like it doesn't matter anymore, if it's all gone tomorrow, I'm still going to be the same person, that is actually the same feeling that some of the people who have absolutely nothing have, because they've got nothing to lose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so that's a bit interesting in our very sort of materialistic society, where we tend to strive, as you say, for things for outside to make us happy, to achieve that happiness. But it's a truly fascinating world to work with people's minds and thoughts and consciousness and feelings and how it all links together.
I think your clients are very, very lucky.
Oh, thank you. Sweet of you. Thank you.
How can our audience contact you to learn more about your work and to engage your services? How can they reach you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let me just say, I'm always happy to talk to people. What I do is I always spend 2 hours free of charge with anyone who wants to just have an idea about what it is that I teach, what it is that I do. So people should always feel free to just reach out to me. And I do work globally. My clients are from all over the world. So if anyone's interested, my website is www.nbrcoaching.com. And that's NBR, like in Nynne Bernstorff Rankløve. So I hope people get that. There's also an email there, which is Nynne@nbrcoaching.com, and there's a phone number there as well. And people should just very much feel free to reach out. I'd be happy to talk to them.
That's great. You've been listening to my Bernstorff Rankløve. If you have the time, I'd love for you to stay on to the end of the show. If not, I'll understand, because it's a little late where you are.
It is a little late, and unfortunately, I have a 2-year-old who's teething at the moment. And
Oh my goodness! I have to let you go. I hope the little one feels better, and it's been an absolute joy to have you on the show. You take care, and the best of success to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
I want to let everyone know that if you want to call into the studio, the number here is 347-539-5285. That's 347-539-5285. And now, from Atlanta, Georgia, we have Dr. Latrice Wallace, who has been very patient and patiently waiting in the wings. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share, and I've learned so much just listening in today.
So have I. And now we're going to learn even more. All right. So much I want to ask you. You are the Assistant Director of Evaluation and Institutional Assessment in the Prevention Research Centers at Morehouse College School of Medicine. Could you talk to us about the work that's done there, and could you describe your role?
Sure. So just to give you all just some background on what we call the PRCs, Prevention Research Center, they're a national network of 26 PRCs across the country, and they're all funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they work with communities to develop, evaluate, and implement major community changes that can prevent and control some of the health issues that plague our communities. And so the Morehouse School of Medicine is the only currently funded PRC in Georgia, and we're also the only one that's housed at a historically Black institution. So our theme has been risk reduction and early detection in African American and other minority communities. So as a social worker, I'm a social worker by education, practice, and passion, I like to say. But as the Assistant Director of Evaluation and Institutional Assessment, it's my pleasure to evaluate these programs that are implemented at the center to serve vulnerable and underrepresented populations and make sure that they're effective. And when they are found to be effective, make sure that that data and evidence can be shared for replication and translation to help individuals in other communities. So in collaboration with our community coalition board, which is made up of a community resident majority. And we basically have decided that men would be a priority population for the Prevention Research Center. And so I'm really excited to be a part of an institution that recognizes the needs of men in general, but will also support the creation and advancement of equity specifically for African American fathers in our communities.
Great. Now, speaking of African American fathers, you have created a groundbreaking collaborative book project titled Engaging and Working with Fathers, Strategies and Lessons Learned. Now, it's going to provide an extraordinary look into the lives of African American fathers, their unique challenges and needs. Now, what is unique about this fatherhood book project is the group of fatherhood practitioners that you're bringing together. You're bringing together African-American women who are working and have worked with African-American fathers. And they are going to tell the story of African-American fathers based on their experiences in working with them. Why create a book project on fathers, particularly African-American fathers? And why bring in a group of African-American women to tell their story?
Sure. So African-American, especially low-income African-American fathers, are among the most underserved populations in need of services. However, there's this disconnect in that the active involvement of these fathers has been demonstrated to produce positive outcomes for children, family, and communities. So while we have the research showing working with these fathers will produce positive outcomes, we have basically a disconnect in that they're being underserved. But there are numerous textbooks and courses on practice with families that make no mention of engaging and working with fathers in general, and especially not African-American fathers that have so many diverse needs and face so many systemic barriers. There's just a few books that talk about issues African-American face in general, but no books that we've kind of like this that we've decided to create that focus on working with African-American fathers that present in various areas from an OBGYN office to the school to even an aging services office. So the chapters in this book will use a case study approach, which is reader-friendly and perfect for kind of deepening our understanding and challenging the existing attitudes and beliefs of some maybe students and faculty or practitioners. And I think as a qualitative researcher, I learned that lived experience can't be denied, and our stories are so powerful and effective in turning the public will, which is what is really needed to help this population. And so as far as bringing together the group of women, on a basic level, my research and practice experience started out working in fatherhood programs, and 85% of the fathers in fatherhood programs are African-American. So you do bring up a very kind of complex question. So bringing together this group of African-American women who work with fathers is complex. It is a dynamic concept, but it's not new. African-American women, whether it's been as concerned citizens or professionals, we've always been critical to movements that impact our families and communities throughout our history as a people in this country. We always band together when there is an injustice. And so men are definitely recognized and seen leading fatherhood organizations and doing great work. But the issues of fathers really go beyond the fatherhood programs and are really needing to be addressed in various sectors. And so with the majority of professionals in these sectors being, you know, schools, health, social services, with the majority of them being women, it's important to know that there are other women that are advocating for fathers, and it's important that they hear from other women and see what they can do to take on the work from where they sit. Our experiences are unique, and they should be shared to encourage and educate others. But I do think it is complex, as you said, but it does have multiple benefits. It calls attention to the need for everyone to participate in ensuring fathers' needs are met, which strengthens our children, our families, and our communities. But it also builds a sisterhood among the women who are somewhat unique in their places of advocating for fathers, and allows us an opportunity to share our unique perspectives and encourage each other as well.
This is fascinating. It seems like there are a number of things going on here. This fatherhood book project is going to give African American fathers a voice, a loud voice within the national and global fatherhood community, and at the same time, it's also going to give African American women who are practitioners that same level of visibility. So we could say both groups, the African American fathers and the African American female professionals, they have a visibility problem within the national and global fatherhood community in terms of having their issues addressed, in terms of research, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, sure. I think that I wouldn't say in the global fatherhood community, because the book is more so for the broader community. I believe the fatherhood community and fatherhood programs are doing the best that they can with the resources that they have to make sure that the needs of fathers are being met. But it's where we, you know, again, get into some of these other sectors like schools and health services and other things, that's where there's been this exclusion, and that's where we need to reach out to those practitioners and make them aware of the needs that the fathers have.
This is kind of historic, because what you're really doing is creating a new body of research that everyone can draw upon.
Absolutely.
That's
phenomenal. The point. That's the point, because if we're always saying we're trying to strengthen families and strengthen, you know, work with children, we have to include fathers, and they're not just going to be served in these, you know, fatherhood programs. One of the struggles that fatherhood programs have is really navigating and finding the right connections in places where they can send fathers to have their diverse needs met. And so we need to start branching out and reaching out to those other practitioners and letting them know what the needs are, so that we have more kind of soldiers in the battle with us, you know, and it's not just the fatherhood community saying these are our needs and things like that. So I'm hoping, again, that this book is going to broaden our kind of cadre of, or the soldiers that are battling this fight with us.
That's great. Dr. Rollins, we have some callers on the line. I have a caller from area code 404. Caller, are you there? Please give us your first name, and what is your comment or question for Dr. Rollins? Okay. I'm going to go to caller from area code 209. Caller from area code 209, are you there? Please give us your first name, and what is your comment or question for Dr. Rollins?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Caller, are you there, please?
Yes, I'm Geraldine Hollis.
This is Hollis.
And,
how are you?
I'm good. I have just been enjoying the show and the inspiration and the sharing and all of the research that's being done, and I'm just being so infused with information. So I'm going to continue to listen, and you all continue to share this good information. It just may help me a lot more.
But before you go, I want to introduce you to Dr. Rollins. Dr. Rollins, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis is one of the icons in the American Civil Rights Movement. She is a member of the Tupelo Nine in Tupelo, Mississippi. And as a result of the action, her actions and the actions of her colleagues who were part of the Tupelo Nine, they moved Mississippi, the state of Mississippi, for the first time into the American Civil Rights Movement.
That's awesome. Phenomenal. Thank you so much for your work, Ms. Hollis.
Well, thank you, Dr. And
thank
I
you
just
so
appreciate
listening.
Being
thank
able to
so
listen in today.
Thank you, Ms. Hollis, for listening. Thanks for calling in. And you, too, are such an inspiration. Thank you for everything. We owe you a lot.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to learn more. It never stops. So all of the information helps me just to do what I do, continue to be the person that I am, to do all of the things that I want to do. Thank you.
And thank you. Now, I believe we have a caller from area code 252. Caller from area code 252, are you there? Would you give us your first name? What is your comment or question for Dr. Rollins? Okay. Well, you can call back. Caller from area code 252, you can call back. Give us a call back, and we'd be more than happy to take your call. You can call us at 347-539-5285. That's 347-539-5285. Okay. Dr. Rollins, we were just talking about the fact that what you were doing is very historic, that you are creating a new body of research for fathers, not only for fathers, but for fatherhood practitioners. Now, we know that African-American fathers have unique challenges. Can you talk about what are some of the critical and unique challenges that African-American fathers have that are different from individual fathers from other ethnic groups?
Sure. And I think these are things that probably your listeners are very familiar with, that African-American men in general, and especially those that have to provide for their children, face numerous challenges as it relates to unemployment, underemployment, unemployment, various health disparities, physical and mental, low educational attainment, high incarceration, you know, just a gamut of things. And one of our co-authors for the book, Patrice Sands of Biedon, she had did research in New Orleans with men, and she basically found that African-American men were saying that they were not happy. And, you know, this is just something that we need to make sure that other practitioners are aware of. But I think the most critical challenge African-American fathers face really are individuals. Individuals who create cultures that produce and enforce the systems that obstruct, hinder, and impoverish. Carol Bebel, she's a great culture advocate in New Orleans, and she said that we are all culture creators. So if there's a way for individuals, just like some of your previous panel members said, changing the mindset, if we can just get people to understand the role that they play in creating culture, whether it be negative, having negative or positive outcomes, we'd be further along as a society. And so the hot and kind of new thing to talk about now is whether or not people have implicit bias and how can we help develop cultural humility and competency. But I found that this conversation has been focused on helping people think about people of a different race than themselves, or but they're not really talking about gender or a combination thereof of race and gender. And so even when we talk about gender-sensitive services, this has been focused on ensuring that services are tailored to the needs of women, which I always have to ask for further understanding, because my experience is that the services throughout history have generally been geared towards women and children. So I think that the stakeholders that this book is targeting are really the emerging practitioners or students, faculty, as well as current professionals in these fields. And so trying to change the culture of academia as well as the culture of practice by taking a preventative approach with students, so that students that go out, they avoid these missed opportunities to meet the needs of this population. And also by taking an intervention approach with current faculty and professionals, they can start to consider and change their interactions with African-American fathers, and also change the assessments that they're doing. So these practitioners can change the culture of organizations, which will change practices, policies, and things that create the barriers and stumbling blocks for fathers. The director, Ava DuVernay, she said that pressure from people can change anything. So if we have enough people who are woke, so to speak, and that they are pressing the key decision makers to change systems, then we can create the change that we want to see for our families and our communities.
Okay. Now, the fatherhood practitioners, they can do a lot to address the critical challenges that African American fathers face. They'll be able to do even more once they have the research that they need, which is what you're going to provide through your book project. But I'm thinking that this is a holistic, there should be a holistic approach. What and should key stakeholders take to support the work that African American fatherhood practitioners or fatherhood practitioners of any ethnicity are doing, because one person can't do it alone. There needs to be everyone involved, because the challenges, as you pointed out, relate to education, mass incarceration, income, underemployment, unemployment, lack of skills, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it again, kind of goes back to, once you kind of make an individual aware of their place and being able to create change and change culture in their organizations and even in their own individual practice, I think that's really the first step. And so this book is kind of a catalyst and just a piece of the solution to address the exclusion of low-income African-American fathers in education, research, practice, and policy. The work, just like you said, it's so diverse and mass that it can't just be the practitioners doing it. But hopefully, because of increased awareness and education, there'll be piqued interest in research, which will inform evidence-based and more inclusive policies that support families and communities, and that is intentionally going to support African-American fathers.
What can we do? You mentioned earlier that African-American fathers are underserved. Are there things that can be done within the fatherhood community to address that and resolve that?
And yes, and again, I believe that those practitioners in the fatherhood community are doing the best they can with the resources they have and making those connections with the resources that they have to make sure that, you know, the fathers that they serve are able to navigate our health and social service systems. But again, we're working from the fatherhood side out, instead of, you know, now let us turn to those individuals who are working in those spaces and get them on board, so that it's not such a hard uphill battle for the fatherhood practitioners when they're trying to link up fathers to different services, or when fathers are even presenting themselves to these different services, that, you know, it's not an uphill battle. The policies are already there to be inclusive. The practitioners are already aware of the issues and know how to meet the needs. So, again, I believe it just really starts with the individual and helping that individual to understand what they can do to change the culture of their organization or their own practice.
It's a problem, the fact that African American fathers do not have equal access to parenting resources and support services, or is the problem that there aren't enough or any parenting resources and support services would address all of their needs, but not only just parenting, but from the legal aspect of child support, paternity, child custody.
Mm-hmm. I believe the issue is in equity. I believe it is in equal access. It's not about there not being enough providers, there are not enough services. I believe it's about access, and you know, there's just several several examples I can give in terms of, you know, just people not even considering the fathers in their different services. So I think African-American fathers are underserved, and they don't have the equal access to resources in the broader community in a number of areas, the education, the public health, and social services. And that's kind of the goal, to create and advance equity in services for these fathers. I just witnessed, even when I take my kids to the doctor, there was a father in there complaining that, you know, they didn't call him, they called the mom, and that created some inconvenience. If they would have just called him, you know, then there wouldn't have been an issue. Even taking my daughter to a cheerleading meeting, the dad was there, and he asked, can there be cheer dad t-shirts instead of there just being cheer mom t-shirts? So it's just, you know, the different systems that our fathers and children interact with just don't even consider fathers, and just don't even think about it. So we just need to remind these different practitioners and folks in these different sectors that fathers are not absent, they're not missing, they're not invisible, they matter, and they should be engaged.
So there needs to be a mindset change here.
Right.
There needs to be some education done somehow to change that mindset. You're right. When something goes wrong with the child, and they immediately bring in the mother.
Absolutely.
And not the father. That's a very good point. What is the connection between, well, we know that African-American fathers, they don't have equal access to support services and resources that they need to positively shape the minds and souls of their children. And yet, they struggle. They struggle and do the best that they can for their children. I mean, you've got African American men who are single dads.
Yes.
Who work, and they pick up the kids from school, they take the daughters to ballet lessons, piano lessons, they take the sons to football practice. Not only that, they coach the neighborhood softball team. But African American fathers get a bad rep. What is up with that? Why
you know,
that?
And we don't have enough time to go into that, but it's definitely history. You know, we can look back through history and see the different images and stereotypes and things that were perpetuated about men, African-American men in general, and also with fathers, different systems and policies that were set up to, you know, exclude. And that's that. But we know that the lived and real experience of folks in our communities, like, it represents what you've just said, that there are single dads who are raising their children. There are dads in homes, whether they be with the mom or not, that are taking their kids to ballet practice, gymnastics practice, football practice, baseball practice, that we know that they are there. And it's just, again, there needs to be this change in mindset of individuals that create these different exclusive policies and practices, and there also needs to be just a change in our culture and the different images and representation that we put out there about African-American fathers.
You know, we have this image of men as not being nurturers and caretakers. Would that have some bearing on why in situations where there's a situation with a child and a parent needs to be called in, where, let's say, the mother and father are both on record, and so they decide to wait for the mother, even though the father is right there and readily available? Do we, in our concept of what we and feel about men have a bearing on why men become invisible, particularly African American men become invisible when we're talking about parenting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There definitely are kind of societal and the socially constructed gender roles definitely have an impact on the decisions that individuals make to engage or not engage fathers. And so, you know, again, that's where the work begins, really starting, you know, with changing mindsets so that this culture and the different roles that people have, again, socially constructed, but are not reflective of the reality, that they can be challenged.
This has been a great conversation, Dr. Rollins. How can our audience get in touch with you to learn more about your work and to learn more about this historic, groundbreaking, collaborative book project on fatherhood that you have launched?
Thank you so much, Ms. Sears. I can be reached on LinkedIn. They can just search for Latrice Rollins and message me or join my network. I can also be reached by email at lrollins01@gmail.com.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our dialogue on issues impacting fathers, their communities, and our world has come to an end. I enjoyed speaking with our guests, Ms. Martea Brown, Mrs. Nye Bernstall-Frankel, and Dr. Latrice Rollins. I certainly learned a lot. I hope you learned a lot, too. I am energized and fired up by what these wonderful souls had to say and the great work that they're doing. I want to thank Ms. Martea Brown, Mrs. Nina Bernstall-Frenklo, and Dr. Latrice Wallace for spending time with us today. I want to thank our producer, Ms. Beverly Black, who always does a fantastic job in putting this show together and keeping everything on track. I want to thank the Tribe Family Channel Network, because without the Tribe Family Channel Network, there would not be an In Search of Fatherhood radio talk show. We'll return on Saturday, May 12, 2018. Until then, take good care, and we'll look forward to talking to you on Saturday, May 12, 2018. Bye-bye.
Wonder what would happen if we just did some random acts of kindness. Stop killing each other. Strength of a million men being kind. Turn this whole thing around. If one man would make up his mind to everyone he meets, be kind, and fix his heart on that which is true. If one man would be so bold as to embrace the gospel and hold, just think what the strength of a million men could do. If one man changed his thought each time the tempter brought some selfish scheme that would his neighbor undo, if he thought for just a minute just where is the kindness in it, just think what a million thoughts like that could do. If David could slay that giant, though huge and extremely defiant, and Solomon had the wisdom to think things through, if Shadrach could walk through fire and his entire village inspire, just think what a million Shadrachs could do. If Noah could build that ark, though some people thought it a lark, and Jesus could cure those deaf and blind men too, if Samson's strength was that of 10 ordinary men, just think what a million Samsons could do. If one man would take a second when his needy neighbor beckoned, and followed literally Moses' 10th command, with spirits filled and nourished, our neighborhoods would flourish. How quickly peace would spread throughout this land. If one man made up his mind to no matter what, be kind, no matter what others might put him through, the strength of that man's resolve would all our problems solve. And just think what a million men like that could do. Just a little kindness. Simple virtue of kindness.